You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Monday, December 18th, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks, and I'm Michael Monday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Stephen A. Cook, Steve Cook, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. The Kurds are winning the war against IS. The Turks feel betrayed. And the United States, finally, under Trump, fully and formally and utterly out of whatever tiny remnants of the closet remained, as completely lopsided in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We'll talk about that, the fallout or not fallout of the U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Plus, the GOP moves forward on a tax bill. There's a new provision in it which is going to help landlords. And that just coincidentally overlapped with Bob Corker flipping his vote on the bill. What was Rod Blagojevich in jail for again? And do we all owe him a massive apology? Tax bill is going to get rid of what little remains, apparently, of Donald Trump's street cred. Apparently, constantly talking about supporting the little guy while pushing through the Republicans' GOP, the GOP's plutocrat policies, might not be working. But what is working, according to Republicans, is their strategy to muddy the waters of the Mueller investigation. We've seen the groundwork being laid there. It's on and it's working with their base. Paranoia grips Capitol Hill as the harassment scandal spreads. Apparently, there's many more congressmen that are going to be in the crosshairs for their behavior.
Bad guys.
Oh, no. Sorry, guys. Should have been more responsible.
Should have won the presidency.
Should have become president. Then you can literally do whatever you want. Diddy, Sean Combs. He wants to buy the Carolina Panthers and hire Colin Kaepernick as quarterback. It's the most innovative idea he's had since the mid-90s. And Ralph Northam, who won a overwhelming victory as Virginia's gubernatorial race a couple of months ago, campaigning on Medicaid expansion, now is sending mixed signals, even as Doug Jones can't just give us a few days to enjoy that Roy Moore isn't in the Senate. All that and more on today's Majority Report. This tax bill is, as we all know, a structural assault on all of the non-wealthy of America. It's a massive wealth redistribution package to the top. It will structure and lock in the next phase of mass inequality, underinvestment in the public services. And it's designed so that if you are a middle-income or poor person, you will suffer or at the very least work much harder to give, as an example, a trust fund baby like Ivanka Trump, not only a tax cut, but the gift of an estate after her father throws off his mortal coil, or whatever that phrase is. And when you think about who is really useful in society and who really provides the most value, you obviously think of the children of the ultra wealthy. They certainly have earned it. They called it.
Especially
the hot ones. Especially the ones who have very close relationships with their fathers. Very close. And believe me, never forced myself on her. And you can see it right here. This is Ivanka Trump on Fox and Friends explaining the accomplishments of the Trump foreign policy. And I want to warn you, if you're watching this or listening to this and you've been thinking to yourself, you know what? Forget it. The whole thing's over. It doesn't matter. I should just spend the rest of my life trying to score as much Molly and ketamine or going skydiving or whatever other hedonistic indulgence or just numbing out is your choice. And life has no meaning. And
doomsday prepper hedonism.
Doomsday prepper hedonism. The evil have won. Good is vanquished. Skip ahead. Don't watch Ivanka Trump speaking, because if you're already staring in the void, she will take you deep into those depths.
Yeah. You just mentioned President Reagan. He had a principle, peace through strength. And coming up this afternoon on Fox News Channel, your dad is going to be appearing, I think, in the Ronald Reagan building in Washington, D.C., to unveil his national security strategy. How is this different than President Obama's national security strategy?
Well, it's based on the principles of America First. It's the principles that he's campaigned on and that he's governed based on since inception. I think what's remarkable
Great
is
movie.
No president has rolled out, it's highly unusual for
a
president to roll out a
she
comprehensive
really
national security strategy within the first year. So this is yet another amazing milestone for this presidency and this administration. And I don't want to share with you too much about the content
of the
speech.
Stuff we heard during the campaign.
But you know, nothing will surprise you. He's been unbelievably consistent, and we're starting to see it really bear fruit in the war against ISIS and extremism around the globe, and in terms of strength and our foundational relationship with those that we are competing with from an economic perspective, if not a security perspective. So you'll hear him articulate that, but it's been an unbelievable, really robust interagency strategy, and it's going to be articulated by the president, which is also unusual.
Yeah.
Normally, the president himself does not share the principles of the national security strategy, but this is so important to him and so significant and so consistent
right.
with the views he's long held and which the American people voted on, that he wanted to share with the American
Terrific.
People himself.
All right, guys, I need a day off. I can't do this. I need to go to a spa or something. I can't. I mean, Jesus Christ. All right. I love how they're also at the point where the year has been such a debacle. And yes, they're almost certainly about to have this massive accomplishment in the form of just the warfare on America and billionaire gift giving that is this tax plan. And essentially, but besides that, it's been such a debacle and so much failure that basically they have to find these narrow nonsense little ways of he'll give a speech about an NSC document. No one's done that before. And it is, it's super unusual that a president give national security address. Jesus Christ.
And should have thought about that, Eric.
Yeah, Eric, what the hell? What happened?
What am I paying for you for, Ben Rhodes?
Ben Rhodes, what a moron. I could have said that I supported Hezbollah all along as a form of a national security address. And, I just have to say, because I am in a surly mood, if you were part of the Jared and Ivanka will restrain Trump contingent, which was always a sort of mind-expandingly stupid position to hold, let me just go to my friend for a second, and I will indulge myself and do this. Let me just go to my friend. Kill yourself. Die. Little message from Peter Thiel. Oh, gosh. What are we going to do, guys? There's just something about it's all of the high-level problems of where we're at in society. And the thing with the Trump administration is that they're and that extra kicker is that you need to know who Ivanka Trump is. I would have gone through life and absolutely not known who she was. Had just completely irrelevant to me. And now she's on television talking about an NSC strategy. That's great. Thanks, guys.
I knew when I saw her on The Apprentice that this woman was going to be representing the White House 10 years down the line.
That's how you get into these great strategy gigs, Brendan. What's the worst Christmas or holiday gift you guys have ever received?
When I was younger, I was really into Egypt, but some of my aunts and uncles overlearned that lesson. So they kept giving me like sort of coffee table books about pyramids, which is fine. But you know.
Bonds as a child.
Is that really that bad?
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. It was like, money, which is actually like the best gift. Ever since I was a kid, I just wanted like Donnie Brasco, you know, just like hand me the envelope with the money. I was intrigued when I was a kid by Native Americans, and some of the gifts that came with that were great, like books and things like that. One person, I will not say who, overlearned it and sent me one of those like hideous like Howling Wolf t-shirts, because that was like what they had in mind. And
Native Americans love those.
Yeah, of course. They really like those. So, you know, look, there's any number of terrible presents and mishaps and gift giving, but there is one surefire way to success, and of course that is Shari's Berries. No matter who you're shopping for this holiday season, Shari's Berries is the perfect gift for everyone on your list. This holiday, my listeners can get fresh and delicious Shari's Berries dipped in white milk and dark chocolatey goodness starting at $19.99 plus shipping and handling. Or check this out. When you double the berries for just 10 or more, your gift will include 4 giant dip berries for free. That's 2 gifts in one. Shari's Berries is more than just berries. They've added amazing new holiday treats like snowman brownie pops, cheesecake Christmas trees, and artisanal chocolate truffles. Huge, fresh, juicy berries topped with rich chocolate chips, chopped nuts, and signature swizzles. They're amazing. You get to choose the delivery date. Customer satisfaction is always hashtag number one, or your money back. Gifts arrive packaged in Shari's Berries signature gift box. No wrapping required. There's only one way to get this amazing $19.99 deal this holiday. Visit berries.com. Click on the microphone in the upper right corner and enter my code, Cedar, S-E-D-E-R, at checkout. Remember, when you double the berries for just 10 or more, your gift will include 4 giant dipped cookies for free. Christmas is a week away. Order today. That's berries.com, code Cedar. We will be right back. Stephen Cook on the Council from the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome back, Michael Brooks on the Majority Report. Joining us now is Stephen Cook. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Steve, thanks so much for being on the Majority Report again, my friend.
It's always a pleasure. How are you?
I'm doing well. Very, very, good. Always just a sort of pleasure to be talking with you, even though we somehow maintain such a good vibe, even in the most horrible of topics.
I can't think of anything more terrible. But, okay, yeah. We do maintain this good vibe despite everything going on around us.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We'll start with the most positive thing I think that we can kind of get out of the Middle East region right now, which is that Kurdish fighters have been running the tables on ISIS for the last couple of months. They've been taking back territory in Syria. They've been liberating towns. You know, I'm not one to idolize anybody, but I've always kind of maintained that, look, if you need a side in this conflict, I cannot think of anyone other than the Syrian Kurds to have some real sort of genuine, you know, sympathy and identity with, ideologically, and as well as in terms of just sort of the literal, just kind of amazing physical courage of their fight. Can you kind of explain those victories and then maybe why, like, what happened? I mean, ISIS was freaking everybody out a couple years ago. I felt like almost a couple years ago, people were thinking way too much about ISIS, and now maybe people are thinking a little too little.
Well, we do tend to go in those cycles about it. You know, remember when Al-Qaeda ate American foreign policy, starting in June 2014, ISIS ate American foreign policy. It was the only thing that anybody could think about. And, you know, American officials would go you know, to Asia and talk about the fight against ISIS and enlisting support in the fight against ISIS. So you're absolutely right. But to your direct question, look, the Syrian Kurds, the fighting force that the United States has been working with, the People's Protection Units, known by its acronym YPG, was set up around the first, second half of 2011 by the Kurdistan Workers Party, this Turkish terrorist organization. The United States recognizes it as a terrorist organization that had been waging war against Turkey since 1984. And the Turkish Kurds went to the Syrian Kurds and said, no good is going to come of this uprising that's happening in Syria. You're going to have to protect yourself. So let us help you set up this fighting force. And over time, those two groups have become inextricably linked. And the PKK has been in the battlefield since, you know, as I said, 1984. And they've imparted a significant amount of advice and personnel to the YPG. And then, of course, you have American special forces that have been working with and coordinating with the YPG. As you said, you know, what other ally would you want in the fight against ISIS in Syria? And I think U.S. Central Command and the Joint Special Operations Command feel precisely the same way and have devoted a significant amount of resources to this fight. It, of course, the whole policy creates all kinds of contradictions for the United States because, of course, the Turks regard the YPG, the Syrian Kurdish forces, as just an extension of the PKK and therefore are terrorists and see the United States as essentially enabling a terrorist state on Turkey's southern border.
Mm. So, and I will just note, we don't have to belabor it, but I know some people are jumping up and down now, and I'll say I share some of the ambivalence of the PKK. They've certainly engaged in campaigns that have targeted and hurt civilians. So I think on some level, that's a fair description for any group or individual who would harm civilians for an ideological end is engaging in terrorism. But I also do recognize the arguments for it, fulfilling a number of other very legitimate, very important political functions. So let me just sort of table that and acknowledge that in the in the audience. But that being said, I mean, okay, it also, though, reveals contradictions in Turkish policy. One contradiction being, was Turkey far too blasé at best, potentially collaborationist at worst, with ISIS itself a couple years ago? And the second being, we've talked so many times, and at this point, I mean, we're just in the full transition. There's no debate anymore about Erdogan and his governance and what it represents. But in the phase of the sort of who is Erdogan, and there are these terrible things, but there's also these really progressive things happening that perhaps he's doing for cynical reasons, but he is doing them. They were opening up. He was the one negotiating with the PKK. He was the one actually making some small but concrete steps in the direction of Kurdish civil rights. So I guess we'll get to why Turkey feels betrayed by the United States, but the first sort of thing out of it for me is that, okay, well, what about Turkey's own ambivalent relationship with ISIS, number one? And then number two, what about its own kind of flip back in the last couple of years to such a nationalist posture with the Kurds that they're even, targeting, I mean, forget the PKK, they're targeting actually, Kurdish civil society and genuine democratic parties.
Right. It's a stunning irony that we've come to this point because only the Justice and Development Party, only the AKP, could have opened a negotiation with the PKK, could have spoken about easing restrictions on Kurdish language, expressions of Kurdish culture. Only that party could have done it based on its worldview. And that worldview was, let's ratchet down the emphasis on Turkishness that's central to Turkish nationalism. Let's relax those ideas and build up the idea that we're all a bunch of happy Muslims in this country that we call Turkey, and we can all be Turkish citizens. What happened, and it began happening really with the spring 2014 municipal elections, what Erdogan found was, although AKP mayors and others didn't lose any races, they did cede some votes to nationalist parties. And he has, and in the spring of 2014, he was looking down the barrel of a presidential election and, importantly, a general election in 2015. And Erdogan is, if anything, a shrewd, careful, and paranoid politician, as all good politicians are. And he made a decision to shift back and capture this kind of nationalist corner of the Turkish electorate. And the idea was that he would secure his place as president, secure a majority in the parliament, and people believed that he would then kind of move back to this negotiation. But of course, violence, the PKK started undertaking violence in the summer of 2015. The election in June 2015 didn't go as well as Erdogan wanted. He was trying to sabotage coalition government talks, and we were often running into a hot war in 2015. The rerun of the elections produced the result that he wanted, but of course, too much blood had been spilled at that point for Erdogan to offer a hand back for negotiations. So that's where we are. The PKK, there's some indication that the PKK, having been battered terribly in this fight with the Turks over the course of the last couple of years, are willing to restart negotiations. We'll see where that goes. But that's why you see this kind of stridently nationalist tone coming out of Ankara. And as you said, it's not just going after the PKK. The leadership of the predominantly Kurdish party, legal party in Turkey, are sitting in jail. So it's
they're social democrats. I mean, I've covered them
right
on my show, and I mean, we actually were making the case, Gene Bajalan and I, that not only is this sort of like a fully paid up open democratic party, some of the models that they even have for kind of broad social democracy and also sort of group identity and rights, it's almost like a world-class synthesis in some ways. So, I mean, these guys that are being oppressed, there's not even any, there's no violence, there's no ambiguity about where they are on the map.
Right. They are social democrats. There's been some conjecture that the leadership does have links to the PKK. I would think that they would, only because these are Turkish Kurds and this is part of the Turkish Kurdish political spectrum, and that they would be in communication with this group. But right. It is this kind of strident Turkish nationalism that overtook Turkish policy when it came to Syria. And when President Obama went to the Turks and said, "Hey, we really need your help on the Islamic State," the Turks said, "Actually, we have other priorities, and that's snuffing out Kurdish nationalism, because the last thing we want to see is this Kurdish, autonomous, independent, whatever you want to call it, statelet entity, whatever, on Turkey's southern border carved out of northern Syria." And so there was this kind of turning a blind eye to extremist groups like ISIS that were going to fight.
Was it a blind eye, or was it, as some people suggest, even a little bit more supportive than just a blind eye?
Turkey, well, there was an evolution.
Yeah.
There was an evolution of Turkish policy here. The Turks initially were willing to, absent an American intervention in Syria, were willing to allow people to use their territory, extremists to use their territory to attack the Assad regime. Mm-hmm. When it came to the Kurds, when it came to Kobani and the ISIS onslaught on Kobani, the Turks decided not to act because essentially ISIS was doing its bidding. There is some evidence, the Turkish newspaper Cumhuriyet, which is a left nationalist alleged keeper of the Ataturkist flame, had allegedly uncovered evidence that the Turks were actually shipping weapons that were coming to the hands of ISIS. The journalists and editor who did those stories ended up in jail for this. Mm-hmm. So there is some circumstantial evidence that they were directly coordinating. There's no doubt, of course, that the Turks were coordinating with Al-Qaeda affiliates in right. Syria. So it's been a ugly, dirty, terrible situation, and it's gotten the Turks all caught up in the Syrian civil war, and has really radicalized Turkish politics.
Is there any, I mean, and now it comes to this piece that you wrote recently in Politico, why Turkey feels burned by Trump, or I guess it was, a couple weeks ago in late November.
Yeah.
Was it because, and we were speculating in the office before this conversation, that Erdogan just feels upset that Trump wasn't more supportive of him unleashing his bodyguards to beat up peaceful protesters in D.C.? What is the...
the rumble on Sheridan Circle.
Oh, my God. I mean...
You know, like everybody else in the Middle East, the Turkish government, people who were supportive of the Turkish government, were really looking forward to President Trump's tenure. They saw Obama as ambivalent about them, and they really believed that, Obama was a creature of the American establishment, bizarrely, and that Trump, having campaigned against the establishment, would side with Turkey, and that Turkey's real problem was in the kind of commentary and the people around Obama from the establishment who disliked Turkey, which was, of course, a complete opposite. The American foreign policy establishment has for years shielded Turkey, right. bent over backwards to prevent an Armenian genocide resolution, all these kinds of things.
Right.
And then following these expectations, there was the belief that, one, Trump would facilitate the extradition of Fethullah Gulen, who the Turkish government accuses of masterminding the failed coup in 2016, believed that the Trump administration would stop coordinating and arming the Syrian Kurds, and believe that they would put an end to the trial of Reza Zarab, this Turkish-Iranian businessman who's now turned state's evidence and is spilling all the beans about Turkey's role in busting sanctions on Iran. Mm-hmm. So none of those things have come to pass. The trial's continued. Fethullah Gulen's extradition process is in the courts. And President Trump and Vice President Pence has said to the Turks, hey, we're going to continue working with the Syrian Kurds. So the Turks are in a rage over all of these issues, and they're in a rage over the commentary about Turkey in the United States and the West more broadly.
Where does this, the thing that kind of always strikes me about Turkey specifically is that I would say, generally speaking, almost every country outside of the United States, and certainly one that's under a kind of U.S. gaze, or maybe more broadly a Western gaze, but let's keep it specific to the United States, they almost always have a legitimate case that either the United States doesn't recognize the full complexity of it, and doesn't care about understanding the full complexity of its situation, and usually that the United States is engaged in its own, foolish, unethical, or hypocritical, or destabilizing policies of its own that have helped feed the problems. That's usually right. And then there's usually also, of course, a tremendous amount of, lack of self-assessment as well, and lack of accountability for, their own policies and their own actions and so on. But I would say I cannot think of a single country, not even Pakistan, because occasionally you hear like Pakistani leaders will occasionally very sort of, they'll outline it. They might not do anything about policy, but they'll say, hey, the United States, the United States backs all of these terrible actors here. They have an unaccountable drone war. They've polluted our environment. Mm-hmm. They've violated human rights. And we have an unaccountable intelligence apparatus, and we back jihadi groups, and we have terrible inequality, and we're a dysfunctional society. They do it all at once. I have never heard, the lack of even the awareness that Turkey doesn't have somebody going like, maybe part of the reason the commentariat isn't looking good is because we went to a foreign capital and unleashed our security detail to beat nonviolent protesters. Maybe the fact that we have relentless, double standards and double speak in our regional foreign policy. I mean, I don't think I've just never seen, maybe other than the United States itself, just such an unbelievable lack of self-awareness.
So the Turks have really kind of, they're in this defensive position. And especially since they feel so burned by the United States and feeling as if the United States has not heard them on the danger of the Gulen movement. And actually, I mean, you could go back, you know, further Obama, further George W. Bush, even back to George H.W. Bush, to the Operation Desert Storm, where Turks have a litany of complaints. But and you're absolutely right, what they're unwilling to acknowledge, and I think this is part of the radicalization of Turkish politics and the way in which the Justice and Development Party, but in particular, the supporters of Erdogan have really closed ranks around him, that there is no, there's an inability and an unwillingness to acknowledge that Turkey has engaged in all kinds of unseemly behavior, and when they have blamed others and their media, which has now been captured by the Justice and Development Party. By one estimate, the Turkish media, 80%, 85% of the Turkish media is controlled by people who are friendly to the government. So that there's this reality that an AKP, an Erdogan-centric reality, that is being embedded in the minds of many Turks. And that thus it's very, very hard for them to acknowledge or come to grips with the fact that, you know, beating up people in Sheridan Circle is a bad thing. Being the biggest jailer of journalists in the world is not something that is becoming of a NATO ally and EU aspirant and strategic ally of the United States. That taking an entire leadership of an entire party, nonviolent party, and throwing them in jail on spurious charges doesn't serve them very well. And so as a result, they say, you know, that people like me, we're just Turkey haters. You know, if you dare point this kind of thing out, you know, you're just an irrational Turkey hater, an Islamophobe, anti-Turkish. You're involved in this cabal to bring Turkey down. This is the kind of discourse that Turkey's been reduced to. It's sad in a way.
Very sad. Sorry. I can't. You know what is actually helpful about this, and then this will get us, I guess, in the last couple of minutes to Jerusalem, is as depressing as it is, and as, you know, really repulsive and a danger, I think, because I was thinking, what are the analogs to Turkey's sort of, you know, sanctimonious kind of narcissistic lack of any sort of ability to kind of self-assess? And I could see it in the United States, and I could also see it in Israel, frankly. You know, like, there is this commonality of kind of far-right governance, which on a deeper structure, if we get rid of, like, oh, well, you know, the clash of Christian, Muslim, and Jewish, we can find, like, deeper global patterns. I mean, and of course, we could actually expand them out and say, like, okay, what is a pattern from, you know, Turkey to Trump to Modi to Putin, obviously. And that's, I think, a broader conversation that's worth having. But, you know, as far as the sort of, like, lack of self-assessment, we're always aggrieved and under danger. I mean, Israel's always a top contender for that award. And I think that, you know, Trump's move on Jerusalem can be read as, you know, as simple as the Mueller thing, whatever it's going to disclose. And I don't think, as I always say, I think it's, you know, it's much more Goodfellas than Manchurian Candidate, but it's not going to look good. I think he's getting ready to fire Mueller. And I think that there's just some element of, like, hey, you know, when does it hurt to stoke your crazy base? This is a move for the crazy base. In Israel, same thing. Israel's governed by the, you know, the extreme far right, and the population gets more and more bigoted and xenophobic and out of control by the day. But on the other hand, I mean, does this just sort of, the United States has obviously always had a biased policy, and it has been, in fact, very pro and very easy on Israel. But there were, you know, from the kind of deeply unfortunate anti-Semitism, George H.W. Bush's Jim Baker's screw the Jews, they don't vote for us anyways, to...
I think it was F the Jews, actually.
Right, F the Jews.
You cleaned it up. This is a family program.
Yeah, excuse me. Well, yeah, we'll wait till the fun half. Then I'll do my impression of Jim Baker at a West Bank brothel. No, but I think, frankly, the delusion of John Kerry, hoping to hold Israel accountable, and because obviously not to editorialize too much, but I mean, at least obviously for who governs Israel, the ship is totally sailed, and of course they're like, yes, we're going to have an unending, occupation and an unequal society. And that's just obvious policy wise, but I mean. There's the stoking the respective bases, and then is there just sort of like formalizing, like, yes, America from, center left to center is pro-Israel, and the right is, not only pro-Israel, just joined at the hip with the most far-right elements of Israeli leadership, and right. That's just how it is.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. Although I have to say, I found it very, very hard to get all spun up about this Jerusalem thing because this is just, it was just acknowledging what, I mean, any objective observer of the situation would conclude, which is that the United States supports the Israeli position on a variety of issues and has engaged in, diplomacy in, I think, very much in good faith. But I think that the expectation was always that the United States was going to support an Israeli position. And I think Trump just basically forced the issue. The idea, and I think a lot of the commentary, both on the right and the left, is defective because it presupposes a peace process that doesn't actually exist.
Right.
And it presupposes a two-state solution that doesn't actually exist.
Right.
So, you have this crazy logic on the very pro-Israel right end of the spectrum, which is this: if you just break some dishes and you demonstrate to the Palestinians and the Arab world that Jerusalem actually is Israel's capital, it will force them to negotiate. I don't understand that logic, but that is essentially what's being articulated. On the left, it is, oh my God, the sky is going to fall. Violence is going to sweep through the region. When in fact, I think the Arab world much more cynical about this. And although there were protests in the West Bank, about 5,000, relatively small, larger in other places, Yemen, Tunisia, the Egyptian government wouldn't even, let five people stand together on this issue. So there was a lot of force applied to people to prevent them from negotiating. But I also think a lot of people in the Arab world shrugged their shoulders and said, well, tell me something I don't know.
Right.
That the United States supports it. I'm going to write a piece about this, and I'm going to start with an anecdote going back to 1997. I was living in Ramallah, and I would go to Jerusalem, and I remember I was hanging out at Damascus Gate, and there was this big, Israeli lefty protest about, sharing the city and so on and so forth. And I was sitting with some Palestinian kids, and I started chit-chatting with them, and I was like, so, what's the deal, guys? Is it going to be two capitals or one? And they're like, oh, no, one capital. I was like, oh, capital of Palestine? And they're like, no, what are you talking about? Capital of Israel. And so, 20 years ago, these Shabab, these 14 and 15-year-olds, they understood what was happening. So I have to believe that the wider Arab world did as well. So
yeah,
the problem with it strikes me is that in order to feed these bases, it's provoking it unnecessarily. It doesn't do anything to advance American interests. There's no upside to it whatsoever for the United States. So, it's purely a political move and a craven one at that.
Well, there's no difference between me and the country. So, in a certain sense, so you're governed by a narcissist. And there's different interpretations of that. No, I'm sorry, I don't mean to get you in trouble, but I will say, I think that we can interpret. I mean, I think it's just pretty objective that it's not exactly like this administration are long-term thinkers, and the sense of what the U.S. national objective is can get pared down very, very quickly to what's going to get some really good, rally lines in Pensacola. But as right, a you know, I just, and that's just the truth. As a final question, I mean, so it seems to me now that I agree with you. I mean, the peace process is dead. It's kind of fraudulent or delusional to even talk about it. Going back years, you had Israeli prime ministers first and foremost. I mean, people talked about, you know, John Kerry kind of was sort of provocative for some people when he mentioned the apartheid word. But the first people to kind of generally use that word and talk about the international consequences of it were centrist Israeli and center-right Israeli politicians, Ehud Olmert and Ehud Barak, and both on multiple occasions. And
Ehud Barak says this all the time.
Literally all the time. And I think, you know,
all the time.
Yeah, and I think so, you know, and it seems to me that, you know, and this is going back, you know, the funny things about those statements from both of them is that it goes back at least to 2003, and the window just expands. So at a certain point, it's like, okay, well, I think that word's going to need to apply, like, now, because as you warned 15 years ago, in 10 years, it'll be like this. 15 years later, right, it still is. So let's be real right here. So, and what they said, and just what seems to me is the kind of only viable option of any type of, like, internationalist or anti-racist perspective is now that whatever we're going to call it, and, you know, whatever the politics are, but the position does need to shift, especially, like, as an example, the EU seems to be the kind of only international actor with some serious kind of views about the equitability of this and creating a durable solution to this. And even the West Bank politicians, who were the only ones holding the two-state solution. Now we do move, it seems to me, just kind of, it's not a battle anymore that we're going to just move to the phase of, okay, if you want all this land and you need to occupy all of it, then everybody needs to have equal civil rights. I mean, what else is there to say?
Yeah, I except no one's going to say that.
Right.
You know, look, in my, I've been sort of a kind of gadfly on this in Washington when it comes to people talking about the two-state solution. I say, well, you know, what evidence do you have available to say that this is even a possibility any longer, given, you know, the numbers, the infrastructure, right, the road building, all, and as you pointed out and have pointed out any number of times, the profile of the Israeli government, which is made up of settlers and annexationists.
Yep.
And people say, well, there's no other alternative. There's no other alternative. There's no other alternative. And, you know, by basically dismissing anything other than the two-state solution, when, you know, no one is much interested in it any longer, especially with the party that holds all the cards, you're just, and this constant kicking the can down the road is producing this situation where, yes, logically, you come to the conclusion, well, there's only one answer, and it's a one-state solution. Everybody has their rights. But at the same time, since no one will countenance that, you are just creating a situation where you are going to have continuous occupation, status quo, periodic violence, and that's the foreseeable future. And what it sets up is basically this slow moving annexation of the West Bank, and that the A word that no one can utter becomes reality.
I utter it, and I predict, I think you're totally right in the macro, but I predict that the position, at least in the American center to center left, of having a sort of, like, I don't think that you can, as we move forward, even like the stakes that Bernie has set down, which isn't one state by national democracy, but it is like, look, I'm on the left, so of course I can't be a supporter of the current Israeli government. I'm going to have to look to, like, you know, Meretz, even though they're marginal, but
right,
they actually
right
reflect me.
I
think that it's going to be total. You have generation of, you know, people, say, under 35, who, if they're on the left, they're of any sort, they're very serious about racism. They're very serious about these things. And, you know, maybe some of them can kind of go to a sort of retro Jewish identity politics that kind of, you know, right. excuses everything. But I would say that ones who are not going to go fully down that kind of Likud route, it's just not going to be tenable to be a Democratic candidate and say, like, you know, and this is the most forward-thinking progressive advancement of transgender rights, and this is why we need to do something about structural racism, and, oh, we support everything Israel does. I simply don't think it's tenable. And I think that issue, maybe at least it will become more of a proper, like, you know, American Democrats are supposedly aligned more with the Labor Party than the Tories. And, you know, instead of just everybody supports the Israel configuration no matter what it is, there's going to at least be an attempt to find corollaries there, like Bernie's done with Moretz.
Right. Yeah, I think that's probably the case with, you know, kind of people on the leftward end of the spectrum, Jews on the leftward end of the spectrum of the Democratic Party, and those even outside the Democratic Party. But your kind of mainstream American Jewish organization that think of themselves as, you know, Obama voters, Hillary Clinton voters, I have found tend to kind of close ranks on the Israel thing, and don't
even generationally.
I think it's mixed, but I think yes, perhaps yeah. generationally, this will change. But I do think it tends to be more mixed. You know, it'll be interesting to see when the AIPAC policy conference rolls around in March. The last couple of years, the protests outside have been generally smaller. It'll be interesting to see how many of these kind of, you know, not in our name or whatever, whether they join the usual kind of coterie of Code Pink and Palestinian activists outside. Not that that's, you know, that's anecdotal, but it's been pretty meager in the past, whether this Jerusalem thing and whether that there is going to be this big push. Of course, you know, AIPAC and the conference is this enormous juggernaut. And so if this happens, what you're saying, I think it happens over a slow period of time. And right. by that time, you know, hey, it's probably going to be too late. I think it's too late now. That's what I've been saying, on this, you know, a few years ago, I said, well, why doesn't the Palestinian Authority just dissolve the Palestinian Authority and mail the keys to Netanyahu? If he wants to occupy it, he should be responsible for it. The problem is that the Palestinian Authority has become a vast network of patronage with your taxpayer money and Europeans' taxpayer money.
Right.
So it's stuck and terrible, and now I'm in a worse mood.
No, I'm sorry,
Steve.
I'm usually
in a good mood when I talk to you.
Yeah, me too. Well, in the future, get ready for it in a couple of years. Actually, we're planning on announcing this later, but Steve and I are actually launching our own Israeli political party. So it's called Yesh Elohim. That sounds good. It's the new center ground Israeli. Be great. Just go there and explain to them, like, why are you here? We're like, because you're wrong.
No, we can run it from, you know, from Brooklyn. And the
yeah, we'll just run it from Brooklyn like with exile votes.
Why not, right?
I love it. Right, I want to become Israeli prime minister who's never there. Just like fly in once a month and be like, you guys got to give up land. Bye.
Hey, that's good falafel. Okay, got it right.
Yeah, that was great. Thanks, guys. All right. Stephen Cook, my brother.
On that note.
Senior fellow Council of Foreign Relations. See you soon. Thanks as always.
And Merry Christmas.
Merry
Christmas.
And Happy Hanukkah and Kwanzaa.
Happy Hanukkah. And Kwanzaa and everything else.
And all the rest. All right. Thanks, man. Take care.
All right. Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Welcome back. Still putting on my headphones here. Actually, I don't need them on until we go over to the fun half. So we're going to go to the fun half. We have plenty of stories for you, lots of sound. Become a member of the Majority Report today. That's how you support and sustain this program. Majority.fm/become a member. There's also a Majority Report kickback link, which you might find useful as well. I know we do. Nothing more to say about that.
We also have a new edit. I don't think this is DJ Danarchy, but I don't have the actual name of who made this. I think they worked with Danarchy.
They're a Danarchy associate?
Yeah, but it's called the Pajama Boys, so I think that's what we'll play instead of La Poupée today.
Ah, exciting stuff. On this week's Michael Brooks Show, tomorrow, Adolf Reed, who's an incredibly important, I mean, he's kind of probably the most important academic you've never heard of. He's going to be on. We're talking about anti-essentialist left politics. And then Will Menaker from Chapo Trap House is going to be in studio. We're going to do the worst nerds in media list and also make fun of Sam Harris. And then on Friday, we're doing another Michael Brooks Show. We're usually live Tuesday nights, but because we're on vacation next week, Friday at 7 p.m., we're going to be live with Corey Pine. We're talking about hope and Vanessa B. Newsom creating a universal public internet. Growing on Patreon, we're at almost $8.90 now. Thanks, everybody. Check it out, Michael Brooks Show on iTunes or Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I'm about to turn the IMs on. We'll see you on the flip side.
The future of this country cannot afford to lose a seat in the very, very close United States Senate. We can't afford it, folks. So get out and vote. Get out and vote. So get out and vote for Roy Moore.
Pajama boys are back. Hey, girls. And the alpha males are black. Pajama boys are back. Hey,
girls. One of our attorneys is a genius.
Pajama boys are back. Hey, girls. And the alpha males are black. Pajama boys are back. Hey,
girls. Steve Bannon is speechless.
I gotta tell you, I think that I have been waiting all my life, and now I just don't know what the hell to say. Said throughout this campaign that I thought that December 12th was going to be a historic day.
Pajama boys are back.
Hey, girls.
And the alpha males are black. Pajama boys are back.
Hey, girls. They're unbelievable people.
Pajama boys are back.
Hey, girls.
And the Africans are black. Pajama boys are back.
Hey, girls.
Don't get triggered.
Snowflakes. Snowflakes. Snowflakes.